Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 60 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for future guests, you can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us and follow the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, I'll send you a little thank you gift. Jim West was on The Infectious Myth number 43, in which we discussed West Nile virus, polio, and ultrasound. He was then in the process of finishing his book, and now that it's been published, it's time to talk about the subject in more detail. He found that in Western countries, particularly in the United States, ultrasound is widely considered to be safe and effective. But in China, research has been more critical, perhaps less biased, and there is significant evidence from this research that it causes damage at the cellular level, in some cases using electron microscopes to see the damage. Combined with evidence of the lack of effectiveness of the technology, its widespread use for non-medical purposes, and other evidence of adverse effects, there is cause for concern. But before we get to my guest, Jim West, here's the feedback of the week. Shane via email said, "I've listened to about 20 of your podcasts recently, and they are very thought-provoking." Thanks, Shane. Nilo on Facebook said, "Through Gary Null's podcast, I heard about the Infectious Myth podcasts. Very interesting indeed. I have no experience with HIV, but I do believe in the concept of Big Pharma, which puts profits for shareholders above public health. And I think this episode on ultrasound is a really good example of a topic that's not discussed that often, but where the issues of safety and effectiveness come to the fore." Now I'd like to welcome my guest, Jim West, to the show. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hello.
Thanks for joining me today. Let's start by defining ultrasound, especially in a medical context. Can you just define what it is?
Ultrasound is, they say it's a form of sound, but it's a very unusual form of sound because the frequencies are above the human range, which is around 20,000 cycles per second or 20,000 hertz.
Right.
So it can range up to, for human use, it can range from around 3 megahertz, million cycles, up to 10 megahertz or even higher. So it's above the frequency range of the radiation from an AM radio antenna, transmitting antenna.
Right. And sound is defined as the basically vibrations in the air, as opposed to radio waves, which are vibrations of different kind.
Technically, sound can travel through water and air and things like that, but ultrasound is pretty much limited to water or solids or bone or tissue, and it doesn't travel through air hardly at all. It's extremely popular form of examination technology that's taken the place of X-rays because it's considered to be harmless, and everybody now knows that X-rays can be harmful.
Right. And X-rays can also be useful, so there's this trade-off between when do I get an X-ray, and doctors sometimes want to say, well, let's just do an X-ray and see. That might not be the smartest thing. I remember, I think one of my children, we had ultrasound, and they put some sort of gel on this, I guess the microphone device, and that was because they needed to have a solid connection between the sound and the fetus, basically.
The transducer.
They call it the transducer.
Yeah, it emits and receives at the same time. to create the echo images.
Okay. And so it seems like there's a lot of purposes to do ultrasound. Everybody's familiar with it in pregnancy. Are there other places in medicine where it's commonly used?
Aside from what?
Aside from the context of pregnancy. I mean, everybody's nowadays, it seems like if you don't get a photo of the ultrasound of your baby, you're not cool. But what other medical contexts is ultrasound commonly used in?
Well, there's been an explosion of uses. They use it to remove the plaque from teeth in a dentist's office. It's becoming a trend there, almost
right.
a standard of use. It's been used to clean laboratory glassware for many years because it shakes the dirt off the glass, and now they use it on teeth. It can be used therapeutically to stimulate bone growth when bone is broken. Athletes could be subjected to ultrasound therapy.
Right.
It's used as an examination technology, not only for the fetus, but for the woman's organs, or any situation where they want to examine the body. It could be a male or a female. One thing they're trying to push it on just about everybody, especially as you grow older, is arteriography, where they study the flow of the blood and to see if you have plaque in your artery, your blood vessel system.
And I guess one of the nice things about ultrasound from a point of view of the doctor is that ultrasound allows you to somewhat see the organism moving, right? Like things like an X-ray are instantaneous, and you get a shot of what you were like at, you know, at a millionth of a second or however long the X-ray takes. But with ultrasound,
right.
You're actually seeing the body moving, and so things like the flow of fluids you can to some extent see. So,
right, you can get a video representation in real time,
right,
of what's happening.
So yeah. it is a powerful diagnostic technique. But I think your major concern is with the use of ultrasound with the fetus. Is that correct?
Right. I'm just focusing on prenatal ultrasound, and that's sort of the title of my book, is the risk of prenatal ultrasound.
Okay. Now, before we move to that, do you believe that there are risks with the use of ultrasound, for example, in bone scan or bone healing or scans of organs? Do you have any information about that, or is that just outside your scope?
Well, the studies are about ultrasound damaged tissue. So the ultrasound, when it's used to stimulate bone growth in an athlete who's broken a bone, is using the same toxic principle that would be used by a drug. The principle is to stress the tissue and to force it to raise its metabolism and increase whatever it's doing. That's the standard pharmaceutical principle, is to raise the metabolism of the patient or the person or the tissue to force it to force it into action, motivate the immune system to start moving. That's sort of the principle of vaccines, in a way, is to stress the person and force them into a defense mode.
Okay, understood. Anyway, let's move on to the use of ultrasound during pregnancy. Now, first, what are the purposes for getting an ultrasound during pregnancy? Like, one of them is vanity, but are there other reasons to get an ultrasound?
One of the reasons is what?
Vanity. You know, you just want to see your baby or find the sex of the baby.
Right.
But are there other purposes?
Well, the main purpose is women and everybody concerned about the birth of the baby are generally in a state of great concern about what could go wrong, and
right.
they think that by having ultrasound there to get these images, which are often actually very crude images, they can somehow detect what is wrong, and they'll have an earlier, safer chance to abort. Or they can, and then there's vanity. But mainly they want to see if there's problems either in the position of the baby or in the shape of the baby, the possible malformations, et cetera.
Well, that's actually interesting because, I mean, America has a war going on continuously about abortion, but I imagine that many of the women who get ultrasound are women who would be highly unlikely to abort their baby because they're fundamentalist Christians or something like that. What happens when a woman, say, sees some kind of abnormality and she's not willing to abort the baby? Is there any benefit in knowing ahead of time that there's a problem?
Well, I think a lot of women, even when they have a Down syndrome child, they choose to raise the child. They feel
right.
obligated to raise that child, and there is that sense of responsibility, which is very noble. A lot of times, there have been studies that have found that the net gain from an ultrasound is really of not much use. I mean, there is no net gain by having an ultrasound, and there is actually many negatives, such as just causing complications due to misinterpretation of the gross images that they produce.
Well, yeah, I guess one of the gross problems could be that if the doctor says there's a major abnormality and there isn't, then you might abort the baby, and it actually would have turned out to be perfectly healthy, which obviously would be a big problem. But yeah, it seems almost completely useless in the case of a woman who's not going to abort the baby, because what are you going to do with the information that you get, especially if it's not 100% accurate?
Well, there are extreme situations where even that mother, her decision would be overridden if they determined that there would be a risk to the mother's life. And it seems like doctors are pretty good at interpreting medical situations as a risk to somebody's life.
Right. So if a woman is starting to have problems during pregnancy that are unexplained, that appear to be related to her pregnancy, then an ultrasound might determine, for example, that the baby is not doing very well, has an organ outside the body, or some other major abnormality?
Oh, right. There are situations where the embryo can implant itself in the wrong, up the fallopian tube, and
right.
That can be considered it usually resolves itself naturally, those kind of problems, but there is a possibility that it could eventually require surgery.
Right.
And supposedly ultrasound has a place in detecting that. The earlier you do ultrasound, the higher the risk, because the more vulnerable the fetus or the embryo or the little pre-baby.
Right,
is, you know.
Right. Well, let's move on to the research that you found, because you found some research in North America, but the majority of the research you reference in your book is from China. So why did the Chinese decide to intensively study ultrasound in the fetus, and then I'll ask you how they did it.
Okay, they did it because it's obviously the best way to get the empirical data to understand exactly what has happened to the human. Because although there are hundreds of animal studies done in the United States and in Europe, those have been deemed officially to be moot, to be arguable, and because they're done on animals like mice and rats, that they do not really apply to human beings, because after all, nobody sees doctors telling us that there's problems from ultrasound. They're saying they do not see any problem.
Right.
And so it has been declared in Europe and America that the human study is the gold standard, and because that's lacking, risk of ultrasound is not known in humans, and therefore it's of great value to do human studies. So the Chinese did the human studies, and they were applauded by Western authorities at the time when they began that.
Right. And I think it's important to note that they were doing these studies on babies that were going to be aborted. Is that correct?
Well, they found women who... the exact scenario, I don't know what it is, but it's always described as these are elective abortions, these are voluntary abortions, mm-hmm. which is a common phenomenon in the West, so there should not be an ethical problem there, and they are careful to be ethical. They're using women who are volunteering for a free abortion or whatever. They're volunteering for abortion. They're going to have an abortion, and they, before they have the abortion, they do what is usually done. They give them a sonogram,
right.
And they do it at various intensities in order to try to get a dose response threshold.
Okay. Okay, and because the baby's going to be aborted, they don't really have the same issues like you if you were doing a ultrasound with a pregnancy that's going to be carried to term, where you don't want to be doing multiple ultrasounds to do an experiment because there might be a problem with the baby.
Right. they've avoided ethical problems, and it's very, very controlled, and they actually use lower intensities than you would find in a Western clinic.
Oh, really? And so what kind of issues did they find with the fetuses? I presume that they did an autopsy or something on the fetus after the abortion.
Well, they did, they examined the abortive matter, and that included the fetus, the cornea, the eye, the brain, the kidney, studied also the chorionic villi, which are the interface capillary-like structures that interface between the maternal structure and the fetal structure for the flow of nutrients. They studied that,
mm-hmm.
and that's some other things. The thyroid gland. They studied that at the fetus.
Right. Okay, so they sounds like they gathered a lot of information from different organs. So what kinds of things did they find about those organs?
Well, they found that low-intensity ultrasound can cause damage to the organs. They used very high technology, electromicroscopy to study visually the structure of the cells.
Mm-hmm.
They used various biochemical tests to study the immune reactions and responses and the oxidation. The antioxidation plasma levels.
Mm-hmm.
They used flow cytometry, which is a sophisticated way of analyzing cells. Cell changes.
Right.
And they used modern technology from 1988 to 2011. That's all up-to-date modern technology, whereas the Western studies are pretty much were very limited. They used sometimes electron microscopy, but in general they were very limited.
Yes,
and they were all done before 19 the mid mostly the mid 1980s. So they were an earlier period in the West, an earlier period of technology.
Right. So the Chinese found definitive changes in the abortive fetus, and presumably they had controls in these studies, like they had fetuses that were aborted without any ultrasound as a comparison, or how did that work?
Well, they always use a what they call a sham-exposed woman and fetus, where they would run them through the same procedure of examination and exposure, but they would have the machine turned to zero rather than a higher intensity.
Okay, so they were that's actually pretty clever. They were actually doing a proper blinded study because they could be concerned that if the woman didn't, if the actual psychological impact of an ultrasound had an impact, then just taking the fetus without any activity at all could result in erroneous information. But if you go through a fake ultrasound session, then the woman's psychological state is the same as a woman who's been through a real ultrasound.
Right. They wanted to, they wanted to have a control there to measure their findings up against the control.
Right. So what are some of the most concerning findings that you noted in these Chinese human studies on ultrasound?
The most disturbing findings?
The most disturbing or concerning findings, yeah.
Well, in my book I list about 15 selected studies which I thought were very clear, and two studies were done where they used electron microscopy to study the brain, and they study the cells, what they call the ultra structure, mm-hmm. which is the fine inner structure of the cell,
right.
The organelle, the mitochondria, and the Golgi bodies, and all these
right.
fine little parts inside the cell. And they noticed that they were swelling, they were necrotic, which means they're dying.
Mm-hmm.
The certain areas of structure were diffused throughout the cell where they should have been more regularly placed within the cell.
Right.
They found the immune system disrupted by the application of ultrasound at any trimester, and usually people think that in the third trimester ultrasound is safe, but they found the immune system disrupted, incapable of cleaning the blood system as it normally does. It's the destruction of the molecular complexes, like the hormonal system,
mm-hmm.
is what it seems to be evidencing, and destruction of the cells on a very fine level, because these are very high frequencies, and so.
Right.
If you think in terms of resonance, they're going to be resonating the smallest particles, the smallest parts of the body, and that could explain why Western scientists say that they could not find damage through the electron microscope, because they were not looking closely enough at the inner part of the body of the cell.
Right.
They were looking at the surface of the cells, and they were not seeing the cells appeared to be okay, but...
Right.
Inside, the very fine structure was damaged.
Okay, so I guess to this point, when you see damage to cells, it's hard to say how that's actually going to be shown in the actual baby, because in these cases, it was aborted. There was no baby. Are there studies that connect the use of ultrasound to any... real problems in babies that are brought to term?
Are you saying like an epidemiological study?
Yeah, epidemiological study or anything that tries to connect the use of ultrasound to consequences in the baby during the first months or years of life.
Well, there have been numerous studies early on. There were, I can't say numerous, but there were several epidemiological studies where population studies where they reviewed populations that had been, back in the days when ultrasound was being introduced, they
mm-hmm.
they had people who had ultrasound and people who did not have ultrasound,
right.
So they could actually do a comparison and try to figure out if there was an effect. And they did find things like reduced intelligence, and they found an increase in left-handedness. Children would tend to be more left-handed than they would have otherwise, those who were exposed to ultrasound. But then these studies were done again, and they were done again, until eventually all of these statistics were declared insignificant or dubious. And that seems to be the case. Every time a study finds something damaging about ultrasound, there's a motivation to do the study over until they eventually find that there's doubt. Once it's out, then they dismiss the study.
That sounds like the CDC with vaccination and autism. They kept, in that case, they didn't keep redoing the studies. They kept reanalyzing the studies until they came up with an analysis that declared there was no connection.
Right. There's a lot more monetary motivation to it's funny how they sort of invert the idea of being careful. Their biggest idea of being careful is to be statistically perfect, but from the view of the industry, you know, the principle of being careful about harm is sort of inverted to the industrial side.
Well, one of the points you made was that in some cases they used. I hate to get technical here, but a p-value of 0.05, which what that means is that if it's non-significant at the 0.05 level, that means that the probability of a real effect is less than 5%, right?
Well, the definition of that is the p-value, like 0.05, is 5%, right?
Yeah.
So what they're saying there is there's a 5% chance that the observed effect in the study is due to chance.
Well, no, in this case it would be 95% chance that it's due to chance, right? Because they're saying there is no effect. So they're or they're saying, oh, I understand. So they're saying that although...
Well, they're looking for a low p-value. That is considered, the lower the p-value, the greater the belief that the observation is valid. So I think...
But if you find a p-value of 0.06...
That's worse.
Right. I guess it depends how you do the experiment and what your...
Right, it depends on which way you're looking at the results. But
right.
But it's supposed to be a measurement of the... of the possibility that the observed observation could be due to chance. So the lower the p-value, the better your observations the more significant they can be.
Right. And you want to be as careful as possible with your statistics when you're dealing with something, when you're trying to find out if something is harmful or not. You want to reject the technology if there's a risk of damage rather than accepting it if there's a risk of damage.
Right, but that whole principle is reversed in favor of industry's concerns that the wonderful benefits of ultrasound might not be available to people if they become too concerned about these dubious observations.
Right, I suspect, I mean, when an industry gets big and powerful, then the principle is kind of turned on its head, and if you're going to find if you want to try to find that ultrasound is dangerous or mammography is dangerous or PSA screening or whatever it is, now that there's a big industry out there, you need to be ultra careful that you don't reject the technology and damage the industry. That seems to be the concern. Whereas if you were just starting with a new technology, presumably you'd be thinking about it. Can we use this safely? And it's better to reject it rather than to allow it into the field and have millions of women exposed to it.
Right. Most of the toxins that hit the human species require that they be proven harmful rather than that they be proven safe.
Right. So the precautionary principle is not used very commonly in
that's the term I was trying to think of, yeah.
Yes.
It's like an inverted precautionary principle. But
right, right. And there also, financially, there would be a huge difference between doing ultrasound routinely, where there would be millions of women a year, versus doing ultrasound when there were fetal problems, where it might be used thousands of times
right.
a year. And the number of machines that would be needed would be dramatically less. Like, most doctors wouldn't need an ultrasound if it was in a an unusual procedure. They would send you to a special center to get the ultrasound done if they felt there was a problem with your pregnancy.
Right, right. In 1984, the NIH issued a consensus statement of all the major ultrasound scientists, and they stated the precautionary principle that they would not endorse routine ultrasound, that it should only be used when a woman has a specific real medical problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time you should use it, and it should be done at the lowest possible intensity and for the briefest period of time. And that was the official statement. And that's even stated, reprinted in the manuals of modern-day ultrasound machines as a disclaimer, so they can always say they told you so.
It's kind of like when you read a drug, the fine print on a drug, which could be many, many pages long, and it will say this drug might cause cancer, it can cause peripheral neuropathy, it can cause liver failure, it can cause kidney failure, it can cause pancreas failure. And they've told you all these things. So if you take the drugs and one of those things happen, they say you were warned and you took the drug anyway.
They say, why did you take this drug?
Yes.
As they're promoting it wildly all over the world.
Well, you list 5 points of caution. Maybe this is from the statement from the 1980s. That it should only be used for medical indications, that the smallest dose possible should be used, it should not be used for commercial or educational purposes, should be avoided in pregnancy, and there should be a lot of education of physicians who do use it. So where did those 5 points come from?
Well, those are the standard points that were also issued around the mid-80s, because a few decades earlier, ultrasound had... I don't know the details, but there's a history of ultrasound page by Dr. Wu, Joseph Wu, and he states that ultrasound had a very dismal introduction into the medical field where there were a lot of problems found,
mm-hmm.
and the whole industry just went into, it just went practically underground and slowly developed and sort of crept back into the medical scene.
Right.
And by 1980, they were still... basically paranoid of the effects that ultrasound could have on the fetus. So the machines were basically sold that produced very, very low intensities.
Right, right.
And then failing to have doctors reporting or studies reporting epidemiological problems, they slowly raised the intensity of the machines, because with higher intensities they can start using more sophisticated technology to get more dramatic
images. Well, that's actually a problem with imaging technologies in general, is that the higher the dosage, the better the picture that you get. This is true of X-rays as well, right?
I would imagine. I think you're right. I think I've read that.
Yeah. And so there's kind of this desire of the imager to say, well, let's use higher power ultrasound, let's use higher power X-ray, because we end up getting better images and they're more useful and we can diagnose more problems. But at the same time, they're exposing the woman and the fetus to higher power levels, maybe higher frequencies.
The manufacturers want no limitations on their ability to do whatever they can to get better images and to develop increasingly sophisticated and very impressive technology, but they want the law not to bind them in any way if they can possibly.
Right, and I presume it would be kind of difficult if for example you know, after the first few months, you realize that your child is having problems. I think in the West we're trained to believe that this is just a random event. It's genetic, or it's a virus, or something. But if a woman is more skeptical, if parents are more skeptical, they might think it might have been vaccination. It might have been some problems that occurred during birth. How many people would think, gee, maybe it was the fact that we had two ultrasounds during birth, something like that?
I think almost nobody is going to think that. It's just not part of our cultural consciousness that ultrasound could possibly be harmful, namely because it's advertised so strongly as to be a harmless technology. They constantly say ultrasound is not X-rays.
Right,
ultrasound is not radiation. Ultrasound is just sound, you know, and you know, they're just echoing off your baby, and you know,
and people would also say, well, gee, you know, these days everybody gets ultrasound, and I don't see an epidemic of dead babies, but we do see epidemics of things like autism, and many other kind of low-level psychological issues, like that they call ADHD, ADD, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And have there been epidemiological studies to try to connect some of these sort of behavioral or psychological issues with?
Well, there are those epidemiological studies I mentioned earlier, and Well, now it's very hard to do it because everybody has ultrasound.
Right.
It's hard to do it. You don't have a control. There's no population that wasn't exposed. But earlier there was a possibility of finding a control. And actually in 2009 there was a study. That's the latest study done in California with a huge hospital system database.
Right.
And they actually found a clear... in terms of odds ratios, the chances that there is ultrasound causation, they found a 2.49 odds ratio for females eventually being diagnosed with ASD, which is the autism
spectrum disorder.
Syndrome disorder. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and that 2.49.
The thing is, they did not put that into the abstract. So anybody who reads the abstract would not know that they actually found something. And furthermore, they argue in every way possible how that observation of the 2.49 OR could be wrong statistically.
Well, the problem with epidemiological studies, like if you look at babies who have or had not had ultrasound while they were fetuses, the problem is if the parents chose that, then there's going to be socioeconomic differences, and that's presumably how they argued that the change that they'd found was not meaningful because it was actually due to some difference between the parents who chose ultrasounds and those who chose not to.
Well, in this case, they found that the highest ASD levels were found in parents who actually were graduate students at the time of their ultrasound mm-hmm. in colleges, and they were actually, people with money, people who were educated, and who had lots of ultrasounds because they had access to the college health clinic,
right?
University health clinic.
There are. We think of disease as a burden on the poor, and that in many cases that's true. But in the cases of diseases that are caused by access to medication, to overdiagnosis, overtreatment, overscanning, in this case, you know, they can be correlated with higher socioeconomic status because people can get more of what it is, more X-rays, more ultrasound.
It's similar to that study you had reviewed about the needle clinics, the clean needle clinics. The cleaner the needle, the fresher the needle, the more... AIDS.
Right. That's the Bruno study from 1997 that found, I think it was like a 20 times higher risk of becoming HIV positive if you used clean needles. And in that case, I think it was that the drug addicts who used clean needles were those who used more drugs because
they had access to the medical system, which itself is a hazard.
Well, that's
obvious, apparently.
I think that's been shown that when there's a strike of doctors, the death rate goes down. So that definitely could be. You refer to a study by Ellisman, 1987, that the mainstream seemed very interested in refuting. Can you just describe what Ellisman found in 1987?
Well, that's an amazing study because Ellisman was a highly reputable neuroscientist in San Diego, and
yep.
he's actually still there,
mm-hmm.
and he has had a long history of grants that fund studies of the neurology of animals and humans,
mm-hmm.
and in this case in 1987 he took rat pups that were at an age where they were equivalent to the second trimester of a human fetus.
Mm-hmm.
In structure and in neurological vulnerability, they were equivalent to a human second trimester fetus. And he took an older ultrasound machine, which was only putting out an intensity of 0.135 milliwatt, when a modern machine can go over 100 milliwatt and sometimes 1,000 milliwatts. And here he was with just 0.135 milliwatt exposing these rat pups. And he found through electron microscopy examination of these neurological myelin that the myelin was improper. It was disrupted. The myelin was disrupted.
And myelin is the sheath that goes around nerves that acts as an insulator. So
right, it's protective sheath, and it's thought to be a protective sheath. But it looks like a protective sheath, but it is considered to be essential because it's like the insulation on a wire. You got to keep all those parts separate, you know.
Well, I think it was stronger than it's considered to be essential. I think it's pretty clear that without myelin, we would not be sentient beings, right?
Right.
We wouldn't have a brain.
It's essential to the neurological structure, and this is disrupted. And he waited a few days and then examined it again, and he found that it was not healing. It's like a permanent damage. And this was in 1987 when he discovered this.
Right.
And nobody repeated his study, which is sort of amazing. They just let it sit there, and nobody talked about it. Nobody discussed it. Nobody challenged him. And that study just sat there.
Yeah, the scientific way to be skeptical would be to repeat the study, and then if you can't repeat it, you can say, see, Ellisman, there's something wrong with your science. But I guess there's always the risk that you might actually repeat the findings, and then they become twice as strong if somebody's been able to replicate them.
Yeah, it's a huge indictment of ultrasound on a dose response level. It's an empirical dose response finding, and for them not to have repeated it seems incredibly unethical.
Right.
But nobody did that until, well, and that was in 1987, and then in 1991, the FDA was lobbied by industry in order to raise the allowable limits of ultrasound by a factor of 8 or more, and
wow.
still nobody repeated Ellisman. So now we have a situation.
So on what basis does the FDA allow this? I mean, is there research done that says that these higher energy levels will be safe?
Well, that's the thing. They claim that it's impossible to prove anything is safe, and what they're doing is waiting for some population study to declare unequivocally that they're observing disease.
I don't see how you could do that, because if it's epidemiological and it's a small percentage of people who are refusing ultrasound, those are probably people who are more likely to eat organic and avoid living in polluted areas and things like that. So you would not have a proper study if you rely on epidemiology. You'd have to do a randomized study. You'd think that would be essential, whether it's on rats or something else.
Well, even if it's randomized, you're still going to have this factor you're talking about, and they would have to try to discount that statistically. And it becomes very complicated. The epidemiological studies can be tweaked and twisted and turned. And
right. Well, yeah, I mean, you can adjust for different factors because the fact is that they're not going to have randomized epidemiological studies. They're not going to say, okay, we're going to randomly pick you to have 5 ultrasounds at high power during pregnancy, and we're going to do none.
Yeah, there's different types of epidemiological studies. One reviews existing records, and the other one actually has women exposed to ultrasound and then studies them.
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't really be an epidemiological study, but I guess what I'm saying is that
it would be in a way.
Yes.
But
it's not what's normally considered that. But if you go into a database of, say, an insurance company, 10 years, with 10 years experience of doing ultrasound and pull out data, then you have all of the socioeconomic characteristics of the people who chose to do or to not to do ultrasound.
I think that statistically you want to match up people that have the same characteristics, and you want to avoid matching up people who have different characteristics.
Yeah, they can certainly do that, but then that's still means that if there's a significant variable that you're not measuring. I mean, they'll probably measure, like, the income of the family, the education level, where they live, things like that. But there may still be things like, do they eat organic food or not, may not be measured. And that could be a significant difference between the groups. Thinking about this, it seems to me that one of the most powerful things that you've said is that ultrasound really, for most women with a normal pregnancy with no indications of problems, is not useful.
Right. There's several studies. Well, it's the hazard of the risk overrides the benefit.
Right, but we can say that there's not a positive risk benefit ratio. That even if the risks are small, the benefits are also small. And even if you don't consider the risk of ultrasound itself, there is a risk of a false diagnosis. So there's a risk of being persuaded to abort a fetus that's actually healthy and things like that.
The doctor is putting himself on record as having examined you, and later on a lawyer could, in court, could say, look at this ultrasound you did. Why didn't you act with further medical procedures when you saw this? Why did you ignore this? So now the doctor is almost forced and required to continue with more and more examinations and tests.
Oh, okay.
The possibility of a misdiagnosis.
Right. So the ultrasound could lead to an amniocentesis or other things, all of which have their own risks. But anyway, I think it seems clear that there's minimal benefit, if any, to the ultrasound, not counting your findings of potential damage. And so if you combine that knowledge with the fact that there may be more damage than is admitted by the FDA, it seems like the logical thing for a pregnant woman to do is to avoid ultrasound.
Well, the Chinese studies were reviewed, and the NIH also says in 1984 that ultrasound should be avoided unless there's a real medical problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that is, luckily, I mean, that's something that if people are educated, they can decide to do. They can just say, you know, we don't want to find out the sex of our baby if that's going to potentially risk the health of the baby. We'll just wait until the baby's born and find out whether it's a boy or a girl, because that's really all we're finding that's of any use whatsoever. And that's just vanity or something like vanity.
Yeah, that's the primary interest that the parents have, and it also becomes the primary interest of the doctors, because they want to please the parents, and they want to bind the parents to the doctor by saying, oh, here we are all together looking at your baby, and it's a boy, you know?
Yeah, it's... I remember that when I only remember having one ultrasound, and maybe it was the third of my three children, because that was in the early 90s, and maybe ultrasound wasn't pushed quite as much as it is now. But I remember how anxious the technician was to show us the picture on the screen. To me, it was just a fuzzy picture. It didn't really mean too much to me. But I guess to some parents, being able to see their baby before the baby is born is magical.
Right.
In fact, it's
definitely used. It is used medically. There's a strange rationalization. Doctors believe they must show a mother an ultrasound of her baby in order to bond the mother to the baby, as if the mother doesn't love her baby.
Well, yeah, it seems to me that humans survived several million years without actually being able to see the fetus until it came out as a baby.
Many ways to perceive your baby without having an ultrasound machine.
I saw recently a kind of a humorous list of, they have these lists, is very popular on the internet, you know, the 10 movie stars who are now really ugly or something like this. But in this case, it was 10 pregnancy photos that failed. And in this one photo, the parents had printed out the ultrasound on paper, and then they taped it over the belly of the mother, and then they took a picture of the father and the mother together, and it was really very tacky. But that's kind of the level. It just illustrates the level of usefulness of the ultrasound. It's just for the vanity of the parents.
Supposedly people, it's common for people to buy you can buy your own ultrasound machine for just, I think, a couple hundred dollars, or you can buy your own, and you can sit at home and watch your baby.
Oh, my God. So somebody who's fascinated by this could do an ultrasound every day.
Yeah, they could do it a couple times a day. Oh, we're just going to watch our baby, you know, all the way till its birth. You know, it's like a theater. Instead of watching TV, you watch your baby on.
Right, and of course, with a home theater, you can hook it up to your big screen TV, and your baby can become the center of your entertainment system.
Yeah, there's an author who wrote a book called The Business of Baby, Jennifer Margulis, and she describes, describes in the book, or some. I think it was her. Misquote, but anyway, there is a description in the book, I believe, where she's invited to a party where everybody sits around and watches this baby on this fetus on the screen there, like a theater, and it went on for like over a half hour. And she was just like really distraught. This was before she'd gotten into ultrasound research,
right.
But she still was distraught over the whole thing. And Tom Cruise supposedly bought a machine. So being rich and being enlightened and educated and all that doesn't really necessarily mean that you realize how dangerous ultrasound could be.
Yeah, to me, it's one of the arguments for a publicly funded healthcare system, because the lack of medical treatment and excessive medical treatment are both problems. And so if something's more equitably available more equitably, there's less likely to be over-treatment, over-diagnosis, things like that. But
if you can remove the profit motive.
Yes, which even in publicly funded healthcare systems exists, because all a doctor has to do is fill out a piece of paper saying, I did 25 ultrasounds today, and they get paid. Even in Canada, you'll get paid for that, right? As long as the government says that ultrasounds at this time during pregnancy are covered by Medicare, then than you get paid for. Anyway, we're running towards the end of our time, Jim. So is there anything important that we left out of this discussion that you'd like to bring up?
That's basically it. We're at the end of our hour.
Yeah, we're close to the end of our hour. Can you just let people know how they can get a copy of your book?
Okay, right now it's on Amazon.com. Just do the keywords, Jim West ultrasound, and you'll see the book. It's an electronic copy, which they can see from on. They can read it on any computer or smartphone or Kindle device, and I also will have a paperback version of this in a few weeks.
Okay, and the title of the book is 50 Human Studies in Utero Conducted in Modern China Indicate Extreme Risk for Prenatal Ultrasound, a new bibliography and commentary by Jim West, published this year, 2015. So
right.
Thank you very much for joining me today, Jim, and
well,
I wish you success with the sales of your book.
Thanks, David.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 60 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or you can join the discussion there, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.